TBRI.
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 TOVD.
TBRI.
TBRI. Trust-based relational intervention.
TBRI is an attachment-based
trauma-informed intervention
that is designed to meet the complex needs
of vulnerable children.
TBRI uses empowering principles
to address physical needs,
connecting principles for attachment needs,
and correcting principles to disarm fear-based behaviors.
While TBRI is based on years of attachment, sensory processing, and neuroscience research,
the heartbeat of TBRI is connection.
Hello and welcome back to the TBRI podcast. We are so excited to bring you another season of shows all about trust-based relational intervention, or TBRI. Here on the podcast, we talk all about different elements of the model itself and also about how TBRI is applied in various systems of care and practice. So we are kicking off season two with a longtime friend of our institute, Amy Abel. Amy is the founder and the owner of Hopalite LLC. She practiced as a school psychologist in Indianapolis, Indiana for 10 years prior to beginning the work of sharing TBRI with parents and professionals in 2017. Hopalite LLC has provided district-level training and consultation in multiple school districts throughout Indiana, as well as several community agencies that support vulnerable children. Amy is a TBRI practitioner, and she's also a TBRI mentor during our TBRI practitioner trainings. And today, she and our host, Sarah Mercado, will be chatting all about TBRI in school systems. So if you know someone who is working in a school, or if you are working in a school, you are going to want to share this episode. So without any further delay, let's jump right in to our conversation with Sarah and Amy.
Welcome to the podcast, Amy. We're excited to have you back.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Could you just share maybe a little bit about yourself? How did you end up in education? And then ultimately, how did you end up with TBRI and doing what you're doing now?
Sure. I started the journey to schools in a kind of a roundabout way. It wasn't really my intention starting out. I went to Hanover College for undergrad and studied psychology. Really thought I was going to move into a clinical psychologist type role. My senior year at Hanover, I took an internship at an inpatient mental health facility and thought it was fascinating. I learned a lot. I experienced a lot. But I was really heartbroken seeing teenagers and children in that sort of facility and thought, well, they don't stay here forever. Where do they go when they leave? And I thought, well, of course, they go to school.
Right.
So the question became, how do I support these kids in a school setting? And went back to Hanover College that fall, and we had a speaker who came to talk about, you know, different careers, and she shared that she was a school psychologist. And so I started doing some research, and I thought, oh my goodness, this sounds amazing. I can help vulnerable children and adolescents in a school setting. I don't have to see them in the crisis level that they're functioning at in the inpatient mental health setting. And so I went to IU Bloomington for graduate school to become a school psychologist. And I loved it. I did that work for about 10 years. And primarily in Indiana, school psychologists focus on psychoeducational evaluation. So it's a lot of IQ testing and achievement testing and supporting kids who have behavioral challenges and social emotional issues and autism and all types of disabilities. And I loved that role and I loved that work. But it's interesting kind of the direction I ended up going. I thought I'd be a school psychologist forever until TBRI came into my life.
Yeah, I think that's so amazing because I appreciated that you said, I didn't have to see them at that most critical, highest level of hurt moment. But I guarantee you there are people that are listening to this that are like, please don't make me go into the school. You know what I mean? And so I love that, like, we all come with, like, right where we're supposed to be in the right place to serve the kids. And clearly schools is a place that you are so gifted and have made such an impact. So can you tell us a little about Hopalite and what you guys do there and how that continues the work?
Sure. So let me preface this with how I jumped from my role as a school psychologist to how I came to start Hopalite.
Perfect.
My husband and I adopted our sons in 2013 and 15 and from China. We have two biological sons as well, and really came face to face with what it meant to parent a child with a history of trauma. And after 3 years of doing it all the wrong way, very traditional parenting, but was failing miserably in our home, went to Empowered to Connect, learned about trust-based relational intervention, and was accepted to practitioner training soon after that, because of course I came home and said, I have to learn more. I need to know how to do this. Our schools don't know this in our educational settings. We need this for our family. And so I started practitioner training, and a year after, almost from when I applied for practitioner training, I had approached my first school at that point and said, hey, I'm really passionate about this. I don't know if this is a need your school has, but I would love to share this and teach all of you. And it was actually the school where my children were attending. And the assistant principal there, who funny enough now works with me at Hopalite, she said, we absolutely need this. We've been searching for a program just like this, and we would love to have you train our staff. So that really started the journey with Hopalite. One school grew into an entire elementary, all the elementary schools in one district to another school district to another school district. I think at this point, we might be working with close to 15 school districts. There are three of us on our team, and multiple community agencies. So it's a huge passion of mine to work with adults, not only to help be a catalyst for their own healing journey, because that is such a big part of what we do with TBRI, but also to equip them in how to support the needs of not just vulnerable children, but all the students they're serving in their classrooms.
Right, right. Absolutely. Man, that is a journey. You didn't play around. You hopped right into it once you got to it. And it's really exciting. I was actually talking to one of the juvenile justice organizations that you trained the other day. And I was like, man, this girl is on the move. I mean, and the outcome of that is going to be so exciting too. And it's just such a great testimony to all of your hard work.
Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah. So let's jump in. You know, I've been thinking about the schools. You know, Howard Bath taught us the three pillars of trauma-wise care, which are felt safety, regulation, and connection. So when I think about the schools, could you talk through the idea of felt safety and maybe where are places specifically in the school that we could develop felt safety and maybe a few ideas on how to do that?
Sure, I absolutely can. I think I want to say too, before I jump into the felt safety piece, as I was talking, consulting with schools all last year, in the midst of this pandemic where it's a collective trauma, not just for the students, but for all of the educators and all the adults leading them, I kept saying to them, this is our roadmap for resiliency. The three pillars of trauma-informed care is the roadmap. This is how we are going to navigate and overcome the impact of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to share that with you before I jumped into the piece about felt safety. Obviously, felt safety it's foundational for all of our functioning. And I don't know that everybody understood that until this pandemic, until people had really experienced that firsthand, because we work with a lot of adults who have a score of zero. Mm-hmm. But felt safety in the classroom is going to be the primary foundation for everything else that we build and everything else that we do. Mm-hmm. So felt safety in a classroom, this looks like the adults utilizing TBRI engagement strategies with consistency. So when we talk about engagement strategies, using an authoritative voice. So being mindful of our tone, volume, and cadence as often as possible, recognizing that we all get dysregulated. We all lose our temper sometimes. We all can talk too fast or too loud, and that can impact the felt safety of our students. But as often as possible, really trying to be mindful of the way at which we're speaking to students. So the authoritative voice, eye contact, making warm eye contact is everything. I always tell teachers, you know, when you're correcting a student and you don't have eye contact, that student can make up all kinds of stories about how angry you are, how mean your face is, and they can feel terrified in that moment of this interaction and what's happening. But if you can get warm eye contact, you've disarmed that child so much. And so eye contact is essential. Healthy touch, which is always funny to talk about in the middle of a pandemic, but healthy touch, and whether that's air high fives or actual high fives or fist bumps or foot handshakes or whatever it is, a pat on the back. Some teachers are very affectionate and they hug their students. Others are less affectionate and but feel great doing a handshake with their students. Whatever it is, all of using healthy touch to connect with our students can be very disarming for their fear, especially if there is a relationship of trust with that teacher and student. Behavior matching is always my favorite. And it's what I found collecting a lot of data this past year is it's the most underutilized engagement strategy in our schools that I have worked with. But just positioning your body similar to that child. I had a teacher at a middle school who her student would not wear his glasses. He didn't like the way he looked in his glasses. So guess what she did? She said, listen, I wear contacts. I don't like the way I look in glasses either. So she said to her student, I'll make you a deal. I will wear my glasses all week next week if you wear your glasses. And so she showed up, she went to class and he didn't have them on. And she walked in with her glasses on and he pulled them out of his pocket and he put them on and he wore, not only started wearing his glasses to school, he started paying attention in class. He started doing work in class. And that is what happens when you have someone who behavior matches you, creates that felt safety in that relationship.
It seems so simple, right? Like I just pulled out my glasses, but it's like, it's even like simpler than that in some ways. And that if you can connect with a kid over a pair of glasses, like that's gold, right? But you can even connect with a kid by, you know, getting down next to them at the desk or having them stand up with you if they're more comfortable, you know, like, so I love the idea of diving into behavior matching being unutilized because it is so easy. And for me, it doesn't challenge my like not wanting to be too vulnerable in the rest of the connection strategies.
Yes, I do love it. I think in everything we do, if we can mirror body language, mirror words, we can notice, hey, you're wearing a black shirt, so am I. If we can just find those ways, it's amazing how disarming that is for kids and how much more they feel connected to us in that moment. I think felt safety opens us for connection.
Absolutely.
And being playful with kids. And some teachers are so incredibly playful, and this is their gift. Even secondary administrators, I'm amazed at how playful our secondary administrators are. So I think using those engagement strategies is a huge part of creating felt safety in relationship with kids.
Do you have any examples of how you would do more playful interactions with the, you know, junior high, middle school, or high school kids? Because I think it's kind of a funny age for us to think about playing with. But the truth is they are such a playful age group.
And so they really are.
Yeah. Within the schools, do you have any ideas or suggestions for, you know, teachers, administrators?
The ones that I feel like have the best skills with playful interaction are the ones who are really attuned to their students. So they kind of are attuned to the needs of the student and they know where the line is not to cross, right? They know that, the student knows that. And maybe the student does toe over the line a little bit so the teacher has to provide some structure, but then they're right back into nurture with the playfulness. And I think it takes that attunement and also just to know how far to push it, how far to go. Playfulness at the secondary level to me always looks like some banter, some back and witty remarks back and forth. The sarcasm is used a lot at the secondary level. And again, I always tell educators, as long as you're attuned to how that recipient is, and you can tell when you need to slow down or back off or pivot a little bit. But a lot of secondary educators just do that so naturally.
Right. I love that. And I think even for the older kids, the idea, like when we look at the behavior matching of just showing interest in what the kid's interested in. So having them write papers about what they're interested in and then being able to dialogue. So you aren't like having to quiz them about what they like. They just tell you what they like, you know, or whatever it is. It's such an opportunity to show interest in and connect that way.
Absolutely. I think in addition to those engagement strategies and using them proactively with students, obviously using them too when we're correcting kids. I kind of mentioned that earlier. Both of those are really important for felt safety. But I think even, and we'll probably talk about this, you know, later, I know with us talking about all three pillars, discussing regulation, but meeting kids' hydration and glucose needs, they do feel safer right. inside their systems when those needs are met. And so providing that opportunities to have a snack, you know, at that 2 hour mark before or after lunch can make such a difference in knowing that my teacher said, didn't just say we were going to have a snack, but every day he or she either provides that or makes time for that and allows for that every single time. And I can count on it. It's predictable and it's consistent. And again, I think that's what was so hard about this past year and why so many people lacked felt safety is nothing was consistent. Right. Nothing was predictable. So the more predictable we can make it, the better. And when we say we're going to do something, we follow through with that.
Right.
Transition supports. If I am transitioning a group of students or a student from A to B, and I've given some advance notice, I have reviewed the schedule for the day, I have given frequent reminders or, you know, and I've prepared them for that shift, I have now made something that could have been more activating for that child and creates a lack of felt safety. I've created safety in doing that. And now this child knows what to expect, knows how to transition, and is prepared to make that shift really smoothly. So I think our transition supports in TBRI are critical.
It's so important. And I'll tell you what, my like self-talk around transitions is to just say it out loud. Because as the adult, I'm constantly thinking through, what do I need to do to move this group of kids in 10 minutes and 5 minutes and 2 minutes and 1 minute now, right? And so it's happening in my brain. And so a lot of my talk is like, just say that out loud. Tell them what's coming. Tell them what's coming. Tell them what's coming, right? Because really what's happening for me is I'm preparing myself too, right? And they need that time as well. And so I love that. And if we think about the whole idea of felt safety, that like, truly, when we feel safe, we're you know, able to do our best learning and our best listening and our best relationships. And if there isn't a greater goal for a school than that, then like it's almost like above education, because that's naturally going to come if we feel safe. And so like taking the time to like really create that dynamic felt safety where the kids can rest and relax and learn. Because
absolutely,
at the end of the year, it kind of happens because the kids feel safe. Well, let's move on and chat about regulation. We're trying to do a lot of creative ways of explaining regulation and sharing different opportunities and artifacts for that. But what would you suggest to people for, you know, elementary and then also, you know, the older kids for regulation?
Sure. I think the most important part of addressing self-regulation is first creating an awareness of what it even is. We can't regulate people or regulate ourselves if we have no awareness that we're dysregulated.
Right.
So when I teach schools about this, we are always talking about two main pieces to create awareness. First of all, we're teaching about the upstairs brain, downstairs brain amygdala. Everybody needs to know that language so that they can start creating some level of mindfulness and awareness of when I'm in my upstairs brain and, oh my goodness, I'm totally in my downstairs brain. And sometimes initially we can't do that in the moment, but it happens in reflection. So I can recognize like, oh, 10 minutes ago, I totally flipped my lid. I was in my downstairs brain. In fact, I think I was in total fight when that happened because I got really defensive. And so we can start reflecting on previous incidents. And the more we do that, the more we can kind of catch ourselves in the moment as we're shifting to downstairs brain. Mm-hmm. Because if we recognize that there's been a shift, now we can do something about it.
Right.
Now I can take steps to regulate myself, whatever that looks like for me. So that's one component, Sarah, that I feel like is critical for even addressing regulation. The second one for me would be teaching the alert program. And with all my clients, we honestly use that both at primary and secondary levels. I think the way we talk about it, the way we engage, you know, with my elementary educators, maybe we're going to actually color the engine plates. We're going to make it really experiential. And then maybe for our older ones, we're going to give them a poster of what this is. We're going to talk mm-hmm. about it. They're going to do a deeper level of reflection. Like, what does it feel like in my body in the red? What does it feel like in my body to be in the blue and be in that hypo-arousal state versus the hyper-arousal state? And when I'm in the green and I'm just right, and how all day long we want to be in the green, but the truth is we're humans and not robots. So we're going to shift into the red. We're going to shift into the blue. And again, we don't always see it right away as it's happening, but if we can reflect and practice mindfulness on an incident that had just happened before that, like, oh my gosh, I think I've been in the blue the last 30 minutes. Well, no wonder I can't concentrate. Or,
right.
Oh, wow. I kind of snapped when I saw that email from that parent and I totally shifted to red. Right. And then it's about that reflection time, which later becomes in the moment time, where I can feel myself move from green to red or green to blue. And when I'm aware of it, now I can actually address and meet my regulation needs. But I think those two components are critical first.
Yeah, that's, I couldn't help but laugh, because I always, like, a signal for me that maybe I was in the red was if I had opened up to email the teacher. Like, don't send that. Like, they're working so hard, Sarah. What are you doing? And so it was like a really good, like, you like hit the nail on the head for the reverse awareness of what was happening with that. And so you kind of got me there. But yeah. Funny. And, you know, it's funny. I was talking to a friend of ours, Marty Smith, the other day, and she uses the terms upregulation and downregulation. Mm-hmm. So the child can understand, this is what it feels like when I'm upregulated, and these are things I need to do to become regulated or to downregulate. And it's fun to see all the creative ways that people bring in, from the alert program to upregulation and down program to, you know, the lion and the gazelle, and, you know, all mm-hmm. of those different types of things to really help paint a picture for all of us what regulation is, because it doesn't matter if we're adults or kids, we're all going to come back to needing co-regulation at some point, right? Like, something will happen where sometimes it takes a village for an adult too, to help Absolutely. Us co-regulate. And so I think it's a good awareness. I appreciate that you talked about the adults' regulation before even the kids.
I think it's the most important part, because we as the adults are the source of regulation for our students. And so to expect a group of kids to be calm, alert, in their upstairs brain, right, as we would say it with TBRI, that can't happen if the adult is running around in a total red state, because children, they have attunement to their teachers, and their regulatory states are going to be impacted by their teachers. So I think it's critical. We have to teach this to students. We do. They need it. We need it more, I think, because we are the ones who are leading these kids. And if I am a dysregulated adult, then I can't do my best functioning as a teacher. And I don't know that we've done a great job as, I don't know if you want to say Americans, if you want to say educators, I mean, I think as a whole in our society, in prioritizing taking care of ourselves and giving ourselves permission to have our needs met, either asking someone to help us meet our needs or prioritizing our own needs, so that we can be regulated enough to meet the needs of the people around us. So there are lots of, I think that's primary for our educators to really, and I'm hoping this summer is just such a time of rejuvenation for them and rest and repair, not escape.
Right.
Escape, I hope so too. And turning it off and just pretending it's not there isn't going to get us where we need to go, but having true rest and repair so that we can all go back into the field and do what we love and do what we were born to do.
Absolutely. So, I completely agree. And I think sometimes, like, we forget that, you know, that our rest and rejuvenation takes care of kids. Right.
Yes.
Like, it really, really transfers over. It's like kind of part of the whole thing.
Yeah. It's not selfish to make that time. I think it's in giving ourselves permission to do that. It's
right.
It's because we take care of ourselves that we are then empowered to care for kids.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we've believed a lie for a long time that it is selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we're supposed to be selfless.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns into martyrdom, and then everybody around us is really angry all at the same time because we're so tired.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's actually like, it's actually, if you think about it, sort of selfless to take care of yourself because you take care better care of others by the same token. So
absolutely.
So now that we understand, you know, kind of the idea of regulation, do you have some ideas for what can we do to coach kids through regulation?
Yeah, I think once they have awareness that they are dysregulated, or an adult has awareness that he or she is dysregulated, now we can do something about it. So when I'm in the blue, when I'm in the red, I think hydration is huge. And we were pretty good about this past year as schools, because everybody had water bottles because of COVID. And so kids were drinking so much more water. Teachers understood that even more because they're in masks, at least they were in here in Indiana. And so lots of water, making sure that kids are getting their glucose needs consistently met. High bar, I always tell schools, if you can make sure your students have a snack in the morning and in the afternoon, you're going to regulate their glucose much, much better. If that's too high of a bar, if they can have one snack a day at that 2 hour mark, in either the morning or the afternoon, whichever one is the trickier time for your group of kids, you get voice and choice about that. It's amazing how many regulation issues go away. And I always explain to teachers that behavior is an expression of our regulation. Mm. Okay. And so if my behavior looks really appropriate, then chances are I'm pretty regulated inside my system. Mm-hmm. But if my behavior is a mess, that is an indicator that I am a very dysregulated person in this moment. And so it's amazing how many teachers, when they institute that snack component, they're like, Amy, 90% of my issues went away. It's not perfect. We're not perfect, but oh my goodness, Amy, it's so much better. I have never had a teacher say, we did snacks and I didn't notice any difference. It's drastic levels of difference for these teachers. Yeah. I think meeting sensory needs, you talked about Marty Smith a little bit ago, and I've had some really great professional development through listening to her sessions. And I just find her so incredibly knowledgeable about meeting sensory needs and how we can upregulate and downregulate students and use the different sensory systems to support those needs and help kids get regulated. So I think meeting their sensory needs, having something cold to drink is going to alert you. Mm-hmm. Having something warm to drink is going to calm you down. Something sweet is going to have this impact or that impact. And so I think it's really neat when you really focus on those sensory needs. Getting physical movement every 2 hours. If we can just schedule these in, just like we schedule everything in school, there's a reading time and there's a math time and there's specials and lunch and recess and all of these pieces. And if we, teachers are so used to being on a schedule, and if they just create and build in time into their schedule to meet these regulation needs, it's incredible how much smoother their days really do go. But in the time that little Johnny or Sarah or whoever flips his or her lid, well, now we can have a calming engagement plan to say, well, these are the five things that really help Sarah calm down, or these are the six things that Johnny really, if we can just give him one of these, he is going to regulate and be able to calm himself. And initially as the adult, I'm going to have to do all that regulating, that right. External regulating, but eventually over time, it'll be more co-regulation. And then after a longer period of time, this child will self-regulate much more often by him or herself, sometimes needing help, but oftentimes doing that alone. Right. And when teachers understand that the development of regulation and how we can utilize these tools, they're not rewards, they're not toys, they're tools for regulation. And when you understand that, it makes such an impact for our students, and we get such better fell safety, better connection, better regulated behavior, and ultimately we get the best academic work out of them.
Right, right. And, you know, sometimes, Amy, I think about, like, teachers, you know, they sign up to teach, and then we tell them, oh, by the way, you're also a co-regulator for 20-some-odd kids. You're also, you know, an immediate nurse should something go awry, right? Like, you wear all these different hats, and I know it's so hard, and it's so overwhelming to keep up with everything on a teacher's plate in the day when their number one goal is, like, I want them to learn something. Like, they're inspired by that and they show up for that. And it is interesting to think, like, almost, if I can like somehow prioritize regulation and connection, then the learning is going to happen so much faster. But my brain, because I have some old school, you know, historical thinking, goes to you listen and you learn, and that's how you do things, because I'm the adult and I tell you to, not, hey, Sarah, you're the safe adult here that's going to create felt safety so they are actually able to learn, versus just being a puppet for you and even asking them to do things they're not able to do, which, you know, Bruce Perry would say is biologically disrespectful. Okay, so, in that same line of thinking of, it's overwhelming to be in a school, it's overwhelming to be responsible for however many kids are in a classroom. And now we're saying, like, go out and connect with them, like go that extra step and connect. So what are some creative ideas you have? I know we've talked through the engagement strategies, but do you have other little creative ideas that you've seen play out in, you know, either elementary or secondary or both, that would really be good examples of just fun ways to connect?
Yeah, I think a lot of people do go into education because they love kids, whether they're 5-year-old right. kids or they're 18-year-old, you know, early adults. I think a lot of people do go into this field because their deep love for children sure. and for students. So I think there are a lot of folks who are already naturally inclined for this work, but I do have several who will say very openly, like, connection is hard for me. And I think two things really come to mind when we talk about connection. And one is, do your own work internally. It's so critical because we are 50% of this relationship with our students. And so if I want to connect with kids, then I need to be mindful of what I'm bringing to the table, be mindful of what's in my history, and be mindful of what is happening in my current circumstances that are going to make me feel more dysregulated, potentially, where my behavior will express that mm-hmm. dysregulation, where I'm a little less patient, or I'm a little bit edgy, I get very authoritarian because I'm in high stress. Mm-hmm. Being aware of all of that is essential. I love how Bessel van der Kolk said something like, trauma doesn't come back as a memory, it comes back as reactions. And I think when we have reactions in our classrooms with students or with our colleagues, even in our personal lives, but I know we're talking about school specifically here, if I'm having an emotional reaction to the student, if I can't in the moment, hopefully afterward, I can get curious about what that was. What button was just pushed? Because those buttons are oftentimes windows to our past mm-hmm. or they're windows to our present. And so really being able to take a look at myself and getting myself to my healthiest place mm-hmm. so that I can engage in this relationship in a healthy way, regardless of the student. Because if I'm engaging in a healthy way, that student has no choice but to meet me in that healthier place as well.
Right.
Over time.
Absolutely. And I think I was teaching in Alaska one time and a guy came up and he said he worked in a residential and he said, you know, our motto or our little tagline when things are going wrong is to stay curious, not furious. And I love that because it's not just curious about what's behind the child's behavior, but also what's behind mine and what's mm-hmm. going on in that. And you can go back and listen to the episodes on attachment and even connecting, empowering, and correcting, and hear a lot of kind of the basis for the things you're saying, even mm-hmm. about mindfulness and being aware of what's happening with us. But I tell you what, I have learned quite sadly over the years that oftentimes I was the instigator of dysregulation, just because oftentimes my fear was coming out mm-hmm. in a dysregulated pattern, and then it was dysregulating kids. And so I think the mindfulness surrounding connection is so important mm-hmm. because our kids are desperate. Like they mm-hmm. really need for us to connect to them. And I would argue now, you know, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have argued this, but now I would argue we need it too.
Yes.
Like, we need it too.
We do. And I think that's the starting point, because we can't control kids, but we can own our 50%.
Right.
And if I can have some awareness, right, if I can, we're not going to easily connect with everybody. We're just, mm-hmm. we're not wired to do that. We're wired for connection, but there are always going to be people, our students, our colleagues that are more challenging. But the goal is to be curious about why that is. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it's because this child, every time I speak, it feels like this child's ignoring me. Oh, being ignored is a big button for me, because when I was in this relationship or in my early, you know, my nuclear family and my family of origin, whatever it is, it's pushing that button. This is not the student that I'm really struggling to connect with. This wound that I have is a barrier between this child and me. And so I think that's part of it. I think that's the hardest part, but the most important part. In terms of connecting directly then with kids, Sarah, I think nurture group is such an incredible way mm-hmm. to connect with kids at the elementary or secondary level. It can be the entire nurture group with Fidelity. It can be components of nurture group. I think our rituals. I remember there was a kindergarten teacher in one of my buildings who was out that day. She was sick. And so she had a sub and all her students were standing in the hallway and the sub went out and she was like, what are you all doing? And they were like, refused to come in the class. So the sub went next door to the teacher and said, they will not come in the class. What do I do? And she was like, oh, you have to like greet them and you have to do that. So this is, and took them through the whole morning daily ritual. And every kid went in the classroom, but they needed that felt safety. Mm-hmm. They needed that connection time, right? To walk into the classroom and to be regulated little kindergartners, as regulated as they can be, and go do their work with a stranger who they weren't expecting to be there that day. So I think our rituals are so deeply connecting. I think,
and how pivotal that once they got that connection, they were able to go in the classroom. Right. That met the need. They were like, not going in there until you meet me here. And then with a stranger, they were able to do that because she connected with them.
Absolutely.
Amy, it is always a joy to talk to you. I swear I learn something every single time. And we're thankful for the work that you do and the way that you reflect TBRI back to us every time we get to hear from you. So we thank you. Good luck heading into a new school year before too long. I'm sure your plate is beyond full, but we're here rooting you on.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity to speak today with you and all the support that you give me.
The TBRI podcast is produced by the Karen Purvis Institute of Child Development at TCU. To learn more about TBRI and the resources mentioned in this episode, please visit child.tcu.edu/podcast.